Now, wolves are a part of a large taxonomic family called Canidae, and the red fox is the only member of that family that we have here in Ireland. No census has ever been done on red foxes here, so we just don't know what the population is, although if anecdotal evidence is anything to go by, it certainly would appear that their numbers are on the rise. I mean, I have a fox. We put a little clip online there a few weeks ago, living in my back garden, and I have another fox. It may well be the same one that when I'm driving home in the evening, I often see it waiting, like at a pedestrian crossing, for me to pass by, and then it passes. I'm not kidding you. This fox actually does this. Anyway, the wily fox, and for sure it is extremely adaptive, and that adaptivity is helped by two things in the main. Firstly, the fact that they're not choosy about what prey they feed on, eating all kinds of food depending on the season and location of their habitat. And secondly, their high reproductive rate, having litters of about four or five cubs every year. They're highly vocal, are great swimmers and great climbers, and they have excellent hearing, which is particularly handy for hunting. They're primarily solitary nocturnal hunters who spend most of the day hidden in sheltered nests or in my back garden, and generally they emerge at dusk and remain active for most of the night. Although traditionally we might have expected to find foxes in woodland and open countryside, it's becoming increasingly common to see them wandering cheekily around urban areas, which is where our series producer Anna Leddy encountered one recently in her garden in Dundrum in Dublin. So Anna, tell me the story.
Well, I was at the counter in my kitchen preparing food for dinner, and I looked out. This was about mid-afternoon. Mm-hmm. The top end of the garden was drenched in a lovely summer sun, and next thing I noticed, a fox there. Now, that's not unusual. We have foxes all the time. But this fox was gnawing very, very insistently at what I thought was its paw to start with, and then I realised it was its tail.
You mean chewing its tail?
Going for its tail, absolutely, absolutely. And this went on and on and on. And I had dinner to prepare, so yeah. After grabbing my camera and taking a picture, I left and I couldn't see directly out the window. So I missed the part where I came back and the tail seemed to be off. And I took pictures of that as well. And then he did something kind of strange. He sat down on what looked to me like the stub of a tail, looked to me like the tail was gone. And then he laid his two hind legs out in front of him, underneath him. And then he put his two front legs between the two back ones. And then he kind of scooched along as if he was itching.
Scratching his bottom sort of thing.
Exactly, exactly. And then I looked around again and he was down at the bottom of the garden. And at that point, I started looking for the tail, but I couldn't see anything. And I certainly wasn't going to go out into the garden while the fox was there. And then next thing he did this magnificent vault up onto the wall and tiptoed away off.
And disappeared.
And he had no tail. But this is a bit of a source of contention in our house and amongst the cynical journalists that surround me up in the office, because they're all saying, where is the evidence? Where's the tail? And I don't know where the tail is, and I've looked in the garden and I absolutely cannot find any evidence.
But did you get a picture of the fox with the tail, gnawing at the tail, and then a picture of fox and tail on ground, separated from each other?
Indeed, really? I do, and they're on
Show
our
me
website.
The picture. Oh, fantastic!
But people are saying, is it attached? Is there a shadow?
There's a shadow. I think that's very interesting. Well, that's like that old gag you used to do with kids with your two thumbs. You know, make your thumb go in half. That kind of thing. That's what it looks like in the picture. Please visit the website right now. Don't miss this moment. rte.ie/mini to have a look at this picture, so you know what we're talking about. So go on now and
so
look.
I absolutely witnessed that this fox had no tail when it walked along the wall and off out of my garden. But my husband says to me, I saw your fox again yesterday. And I say, well, did he have a tail? And he said, yes. And I said, then it wasn't my fox. So it's causing a lot of marital discord in our house at the moment.
Oh, really? So there's going to be a separation elsewhere. Not just between the fox. Richard, put your headphones on. We've got Andrew Byrne, who is our vet from the Bray Vet in Bray in County Wicklow. And we've got Dave Wall, who is a citizen science officer with the National Biodiversity Data Centre and formerly ran UCD's Urban Fox Project. Dave, have you ever heard of this kind of thing happening before?
Well, there's certainly a lot of anecdotal evidence and stories of foxes with mange chewing their tails off. There's very little photographic evidence, though.
Well, Anna has the photographic evidence. Have you seen the picture?
I have, yeah.
And what do you think?
I mean, it's feasible. Mange is an extremely dreadful disease for
foxes. So is that what you think it is?
Oh, it's, I mean, it's clearly, the animal clearly has quite a bad dose of mange, and it's extremely distressing for a fox because they're constantly itching, they're constantly in discomfort, and also they get secondary infections, and ultimately mange in foxes is fatal in many cases. So you could see a situation where a fox possibly had a bad area of mange at the base of the tail and it was chewing away and chewing away and chewing away at it, and ultimately the inevitable happens. Quite gruesome, though.
It is. Can we do anything to prevent mange? Can we do anything to treat mange in wild animals? Should we do anything? I suppose that's a question really for Andrew Byrne. Andrew.
Derek, hello. Nowadays, we certainly can treat mange. It used to be very difficult. There were very limited drugs, and a lot of the drugs involved washing, which wasn't going to happen with a fox. There are some new treatments available in the last couple of years that were designed primarily for treating ectoparasites like fleas and ticks in dogs that are given in tablet form in the food. But they're highly effective against all external parasites, including mange, and extremely effective against mange. So they can be given in a situation like this where you have a fox coming into the garden. It is possible now to get a tablet from your vet, and you could put it in food, and it's very effective. Normal control would involve giving it monthly, but even we know that a single dose is enough to kill sarcoptic mange. Now foxes live in, although they're solitary animals, to some extent the density of foxes in urban areas is so big that they're going to probably come back into contact with mange again and reinfect themselves. So if you had a regular visitor, you'd probably need to repeat the treatment again. It is what we call off-label use. It's not licensed for foxes, it's licensed for dogs.
No, I wouldn't imagine it is.
But not at all, and it won't be. But we know from a humane point of view, it's acceptable to use an unlicensed product like that because mange causes terrible distress to the foxes.
But there's no danger that you could be causing more distress to the animal by leaving out a tablet that's not licensed for that animal, no? I'm just erring on the side of caution here, Andrew.
Absolutely, no. I mean, they had been used in foxes, and no, there's been no reports of any adverse reactions.
Can you overdose?
Very close to the dog. You can. You've got to be a little bit careful about foxes' body weight because foxes are much lighter than you think they are. Most foxes are only between about 3 and 5 kilograms.
Really?
So you have to use a very low end. Like when you feel them when they come into the surgery injured, they're terribly thin, they're quite low in body weight. So you just need, that's quite a wide margin of body weight in these drugs, and these drugs are extremely safe for mammals. They're actually a very, very wide safety margin. They're extremely safe. So if you accidentally used a higher dose, you would actually do no harm. But you just need to dose at the lower end.
So but how often would you have to dose? I mean, if I had the mange and you gave me one tablet, would that be me cured forever?
It would cure you in one go, unless you became reinfected again. So yep. What I would say is a single dose and then watch and see what
so you
happens.
Might have to keep giving more doses. Again. And how often would you give a dose?
It's once a month. The drug lasts for about a month.
All right.
And I'd say in most cases, a single dose would do the trick.
Andrew, I actually went to the vet to get some advice. And what I was told was, if we gave you something, how do you know that you'd be dosing the correct fox? And plus which, you have to give repeat treatment. And how can you monitor or manage that in any way? So, and they said, and also you probably need to get quite close to the fox. So I thought I'd done my good deed for the day at that point. And whilst I was concerned for the distress of the fox, I thought, I think that's my job done here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a dilemma in treating wildlife, and there are philosophical arguments as to whether, in fact, you should ever treat wildlife, because should you let nature take its course and therefore not intervene at all? There's another philosophical argument that says that the encroachment of man into natural habitats is such that we've upset the balance anyway, and maybe we've disturbed things, and perhaps then there is a justification sometimes for intervening on humane grounds. And in a case like that, yes, you've got to try and target the fox itself. Usually in neighbourhoods, and certainly in my neighbourhood, there is a regular fox that comes around. And very often people would say that there is a particular fox that comes to their guard on a regular basis. And so chances are you're going to get the right fox. And if you did give this treatment to a fox without mange, it wouldn't do any harm. So I think in a case like that where there's severe distress ongoing, I think it's reasonable to try and treat in order to alleviate that suffering.
Now, Anna thinks that this fox actually chewed its own tail off, Andrew. Have you ever had a fox in your surgery that had or was missing a tail? And if this fox did actually chew its own tail off, I mean, can it live without its tail? I mean, presumably it has a tail for a reason.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. People say, why do dogs have tails? And some people facetiously say to wag them. With a fox, they can certainly live without the tail. It's an interesting question, why you chew the tail off. I've not seen a fox come in where I could say the tail was chewed off, but tails can drop off. And whether there's, and this fox in the photographs definitely has mange. Now, whether the, is this a correlation or is this a cause and effect relationship? You know, did he, did his tail fall off because he was persistently chewing and causing self-trauma because of the irritation?
He was working very, very, very hard with his sharp teeth on that part of his anatomy. And I'm staking my life on it that he chewed the tail off. And
you're staking your career on it. What about your life?
To know is, Andrew, what happened to the tail?
I mean, I guess, you know, in terms of chewing the tail off, I'm absolutely certain he could chew the tail off, whether it was because of the mange causing irritation or whether he had a, what we call ischemic necrosis of the tail, which is where the blood supply to the tail gets cut off from a different injury, in which case the tail dies and it becomes insensitive to pain and it starts to decompose or dry up, and then they can chew it off. And when it fell off, I mean, I would be surprised if he ate it himself, but what could certainly have happened was that another fox could have come and taken it. There isn't much meat on the tail, but any members of the canine family, even domestic dogs, never mind foxes, are attracted to decomposed tissue like carrion. And so another fox might have seen it as a possible free meal and took it away. I don't honestly know if the fox himself would have taken it and eaten it. I think that's unlikely. I think it's probably more likely that another fox in the neighbourhood came and carried it away.
This is all supposition, Andrew, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. It is, yeah.
Well, there are certainly plenty of foxes around. Somebody who was coming to visit us the other day on the way up our road counted 5 foxes.
Can I tell you something? The next time I go to the supermarket, I'll be looking at that the name on that soup very carefully, that it says oxtail and not foxtail. Richard?
Andrew, tails are a very useful thing to have, but...
How would you know?
Well, look at it. I don't... let the animals tell you. Look at the monkeys. They climb. They need balance, you know, tightrope walking, all that kind of thing. Squirrels. It's a great thing to have an old tail if you're jumping around in and out of things. But the trouble is they come at a price. Because if something goes after you and he just about manages to catch you, it is your tail that he will catch. And if you're rushing across the street with the car coming down at 90 miles an hour, it's the tail that might get under the wheel. So injuries to tails, it seems to me, must be a long-term liability on foxes generally. Now, if you look at things like reptiles, lizards and so forth, if you catch one of them, the tail will fall off in your hand and it'll run away and grow a new one. So they have a mechanism there against this particular thing. Is there any hint that in the fox evolution there is some kind of program for these extreme circumstances so that he's predisposed to survive losing a tail?
I don't think there's any mechanism that allows him to lose the tail. And certainly in those instances, say they get caught by a predator by the tail or running across the road, tail, what we call tail pull injuries are very common, where they run across the road, the wheel grips the tail and the fox is still going. We see this in cats very commonly, and it dislocates the tail and pulls and damages the nerves in the tail, and the tail eventually dies. So they frequently lose them. We know from domesticated animals that if they lose a tail or tail is removed for any reason, they function perfectly well and balance doesn't appear to be an issue. So I think in terms of survival and function without a tail, I think is unimpeded. But they don't have, there's no mechanism like the reptiles by which they can shed the tail. If the tail comes off, it's because the tail has died due to lack of blood supply from either trauma or from infection that has damaged the blood supply to the tail.
Andrew, I'm surrounded by species racists here. You know, there's two animals involved here. There's the fox, but there is an even more fascinating animal, and that's the scabic mite. This is a tiny little fellow, terribly small, can't fly or anything, could creep just a few centimetres of his life or something. The female goes down into the fox, in under the skin, and sheds her eggs, and the eggs hatch out in 2 weeks. This is how she works. Now, That is an extraordinary achievement. How does this little mite manage to get around? I mean, if...
So you're all for the mite that causes the mange, is what you're saying?
Oh, I'm neutral as to recommendations of any kind. But I'm just wondering about... It is an extraordinary mechanism that has evolved here. You have this microscopic thing. I believe it's so small you can hardly even see it with the naked eye. Yet it's capable of getting around. And if Anna has a family of foxes down in her garden, how does the mite get from them to the ones down the road 100 metres away or something? How does it get around? How does it achieve this? Isn't it a remarkable creature?
They are remarkable creatures, and I have a healthy respect for parasites in general. I mean, they've been around, we know, in evolutionary terms for a very, very long time. And many of them, like the sarcoptic mite, are very, very small. They're incredibly successful. They generally don't want to kill the host. If you're a parasite, it's not a really good thing in evolutionary terms if your host dies because of your infection, because then you're likely to die. And for the scabies mite to pass from one to another, then the little immature mites have to pass from one animal to the next. And so it's usually by direct or indirect contact. And the most common way would be from the mother passing the mites on to the litter of cubs when she's nursing them. And that's the most common way. And so the litter then grow up with mites on them. And this is why even in domestic animals, we would tend to see mite infections most commonly in young animals, because they've recently picked them up. As they get older, the animal's immune system helps protect them. And you'll get some inflammatory reactions in the skin that will limit the mites. And in a way, the parasite wants that. In order to survive, the parasite needs to be able to live and reproduce, but it wants the host to stay alive long enough to pass on to another. And it does raise the argument whether or not we ever could eradicate these parasites, or more importantly, should we eradicate these parasites, or should we control them to a level that's acceptable in domesticated animals. There's a lot of questions as to whether or not parasites might actually do a lot of good in some respects. I mean, overall in our body, we're not alone. Our body has got, if you like, parasites inside. We have bacteria in our gut, for example, that we need. And you could argue whether that is parasitic, or whether it's a symbiotic relationship, or whether it's both. So I think there's a lot about parasites that we don't fully understand in terms of where they fit into the bigger picture and the balance in nature. And I think they're certainly deserving of our respect. And I think we have to be very careful when it comes to what degree we decide to control them in wildlife.
I think what we'll do, Andrew, is get you in a few weeks' time with a parasitologist and Richard and Aina and have a big powwow. And I'll just step outside the door like most of the listeners and have a cup of tea. Anyway, Aina, yeah.
Anna, even.
Anna, sorry. Yes, Anna, yes.
By way of an addendum to the story, yesterday evening my husband arrived into our kitchen triumphantly to announce that he had seen the fox and that it actually had a very thin tail. Now, I just want to say that my belief is that there's a whole bunch of foxes that are polluted with these parasites.
Well, it could be the same family.
And I'm sticking to my guns.
Well, you can have a look on the website, rte.ie/Mooney. Andrew Byrne, thank you very much indeed. Back to your summer holidays with your in-laws in the UK. Thank you, Andrew.
You're welcome.
Andrew's fantastic, isn't he? He's brilliant. And Dave Wall, Dave, we were saying that we don't really know about the numbers of foxes in Ireland. Have you any ideas what kind of numbers they are? Are they healthy? It seems like they are.
Yeah, they're certainly widespread and abundant, and they're geared up to survive very well. They've very good reproductive capabilities. So even if foxes get hit hard, let's say, for example, they get hit by mange in an urban environment. Some years ago, the city of Bristol, which had a fox population density of up to 37 foxes per square kilometre, at one stage, lost up to 95% of its fox population due to mange, due to an outbreak of mange, which spread rapidly because of the high densities. And yet that population is well into recovery at this stage. If they lose a lot of animals, they basically up their reproductive rate to compensate for that. In terms of number of animals in Ireland, Tom Hayden and Rory Harrington in their book Exploring Irish Mammals had a kind of a guesstimate of about 150,000 to 200,000 based on UK figures and applying them here. The real answer is we simply don't know.
I was going to say that book is over 10 years old at this stage, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, in some areas of the UK, they've been saying that in urban areas, the fox population seems to be increasing, but there is some debate about whether that was due to previous under-recording of foxes in urban environments. In Dublin, for example, we know there's been foxes around since Victorian times because those records have been there. they've certainly benefited from green leafy suburbs, and they do best in that kind of environment. But whether the fox population is still increasing or not, it's very much a question that's still hanging there. And until we do a full census, we won't really know the answer to that.
Well, perhaps you'll do one.
It'd be nice, but it takes a lot of time and costs a lot of money. What people can do, though, is if they see, quite often we get queries, well, I saw fox, what can I do with this information? You can still submit your sightings to the National Biodiversity Data Centre. We've something like 11,000 fox records in the data centre, which isn't bad considering foxes are nocturnal and outside of cities, they're largely quite hard to detect. So if people see a fox, they can still submit that sighting online.
Dave, thank you very much indeed. And visit the website for details how you could do that. rte.ie/Mooney. And Anna, thank you very much indeed for coming in. And please have a look at that picture, because it really is a fascinating bit. This one for the newspapers, it really is. You look at it, you ask yourself, has the fox lost its tail or not? Or is it a trick of the camera? Or is it just a shadow? Have a look for yourself. rte.ie/Mooney.